Lots of people get a little nervous about going to the doctor's office. Even if we've gone for routine checkup, we might leave with some information that will change our lives or at least our daily routines. Now think about the other side of the transaction. Even the doctor can come into the room with some level of nervousness, which runs counter to the image of the godlike heroes we see on TV medical dramas. But doctors have their own issues, as is well documented by our next guest in a new book. Carolyn Elton is the author of Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors, in which we get some stories about the difficulties in doctoring and even getting to be a doctor in the first place. Carolyn Elton is British and works as a vocational psychologist. Carolyn has worked with doctors for decades and founded the Careers Unit under UK's National Health Service. Carolyn, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for inviting me.
We have had previous discussions about how doctors can serve patients better, but from the outset of your book, it appears some doctors need to help themselves, too.
Well, there's that great adage, physician, heal thyself, which I think is very mistaken, because really physicians can't heal themselves like anybody else, as they are also human. They need to get help.
Indeed. Are they reluctant to admit needing your services because they are held up as healers?
I think they're reluctant to admit any form of help, and that's not because individual doctors have got a great, you know, they're just too big-headed or whatever. It's a culture which promulgates the myth that doctors, as you say, are a little bit superhuman and they don't actually need help. So across the world, there is evidence that stigma of asking for help is a very real barrier.
The first story that you provide in the book, and you are clear about the fact that you have changed names and circumstances enough to make the people unrecognizable, but the first story is of someone just finishing medical school, and this person contacts you and says, I don't know if I can do this. I mean, does that happen a lot?
Yeah, absolutely does happen a lot. It happens both in the U.S. and also in the U.K. Yeah, it was actually an email that pinged into my inbox as I landed in the U.S., to visit my son who lives in Washington, D.C., and it was a real cri de coeur. And it was, I tried to pass the email to a colleague and I only got their voicemail, so I actually had to deal with it myself, because one of the other issues, and that's been highlighted recently in the U.S., is high incidence of suicide. And I didn't want to come back to my office after visiting my son 2 weeks later and reading the papers about a suicide of a young medical student who was about to start their first residency.
So let's reassure people who are concerned now that they've heard about this story. This did work out relatively well in this circumstance, didn't it?
Yeah, no, it did. It did work out well. And as you say, details in the book have been changed, but also everybody's given me, even though details were changed, everybody has given me permission to write about it. And almost nobody refused, because I think that doctors who run into difficulties were very grateful for the help that myself and colleagues provided, and they feel passionately that more needs to be done.
So did the person who was having that moment of crisis stick with medicine?
He has stuck with medicine. He's not sure in the longer term whether he's going to stick with medicine, but again, it's a bit hit and miss, and I think it's the same in the States. A lot of it depends on the quality of your first job, and he's landed up in a good program, a good residency program, and he was getting good support. And so I think in his case, it was more anxiety, kind of pre-nerves, than actually not being suited to medical practice.
Let's talk about medical training, because I guess I was a little surprised to find out that it is as hard on people in the UK as it is in the United States. You've got long hours and long shifts and a lot of the same thing that goes on this side of the Atlantic as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're different pressures in the sense that we work shorter hours. There's some European working time laws. What's going to happen with Brexit, we don't know at this point, but maximum hours per week in the US is 80, whereas it's 48 in the UK. That they can't be forced to work above 48 hours. You can opt to, but you can't be made to. Maximum per day is 16 in the States, it's 13 in the UK. It's even less in Scandinavia. But I think that, so in some ways it's better. It's easier to get part-time work for more doctors. In the US, you've just gone over 50%. Reached 50% of medical students being female. In the UK, we're between 55 to 60. And I think in some ways it's easier for women in the UK, because part-time work when you're a resident is pretty much a right. So you will get that. But that means that your training goes on forever. You still have the same body of knowledge, the same skills you've got to acquire.
Oh, and if you have to spread it over
so
a certain number of hours.
If you're working less hours per day and you're allowed to go part-time, maternity leave, for example, 12 weeks in the States, at least 6 months, but you'll always get a year off. So that's great in some ways, but it does mean training goes on forever. And also because we work, have a national health system, you belong not to a hospital, but you belong to a region. So you can be moved around a much greater geographical location.
And it sounds like from you, the way you describe training in the UK, there's always a next milestone to reach, a next appointment.
But I think that's the same in the US, actually. Mm-hmm. And some of the authors who've been writing about physician suicide and physician burnout talk about that. That, you know, from the time somebody's in college and thinks about pre-med and then their MCAT scores and then their med schools and then their licensing exam and then their residency application and then goes on and on and on.
Now, you mentioned a few moments ago we were talking about when a physician is feeling like they're having some bad pressures and stuff, that there's not a lot to talk about there. You give a label to this, the conspiracy of silence. Silence about what?
That they are struggling. I mean, I spoke to most of the studies and most of the case studies, because obviously my client work is UK based, but I've talked to doctors in the US as well. And one just talked to me who started her residency last year in Chicago, obviously anonymous, but she talked about from their first day onwards, they were not encouraged to say they were struggling, they were asking for help, they weren't sure how to do things. There was a culture that if you asked that, you would be seen to be not quite good enough. So you shut up.
And that also includes...
We don't want to hear that as patients, do we?
No, and apparently you can't talk to people outside the profession either.
No, because that's, there's a certain sort of clubbishness and a feeling that what happens at work stays at work.
Well, we learn a lot about doctors and the trials and tribulations they go through on the other side of the medical transaction. In the book, Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors, Carolyn Elton is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Carolyn Elton, a vocational psychologist in the United Kingdom, on the line from London talking about what she has learned about the medical profession from years of helping people deal with the exigencies of their profession. And it's a tricky business. It's important, obviously. Physicians have important things to do, but they also have lives. And the book is called Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors. You can join the conversation with Carolyn on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So I can imagine, Carolyn, in the years you've spent along the elbows of doctors, you've probably learned a fair amount of doctoring from them.
Well, I have, but I wouldn't want to, I would never want to put it into practice at any moment. I'm very respectful of what they've learned and what they can do, but they've certainly told me a lot about their work. Yeah,
which was the point I was reaching, that you're able to make some observations about not medical procedures, but the ways in which they deal with medical procedures in their lives.
Absolutely, and that's a very much a reason why I wanted to write the book, because I sat in an office in central London, and although the kind of details of everybody's stories were different, and certain themes occurred again and again and again, and they form the chapters to the book, like the transition from medical student to being a junior doctor, how one day you're a student and the next day suddenly somebody was telling me this very morning about how, you can be on your own in a ward, just not knowing what you're supposed to be doing, and everybody else has gone.
That was the story that floored me right there in the first chapter of the book. My jaw was on the floor as you described a doctor's first day in a surgical ward. She has really no idea what she's doing, can't get the help from the people she needs because they're off doing something else. She's got this woman in bed who says, "Doctor, am I dying?" who looks all gray, and boy, didn't know
what
to do.
They have to call another colleague walks by the corridor, and who's also started, and sees her friend, like the intern looking really paralyzed with fear, comes in and says, "I'll call mum." And he said, "What do you mean you'll call mum?" "Well, my mum's an intensive care nurse. She'll come." So they call mum. And mum does come along and says, "Uh-oh, this patient is very sick." and then is able to summon everybody else in the way that this intern on day one hadn't. But I don't think it's any different in the States. And the, you know, there are data both in the UK, the transition dates all change on the first Wednesday in August. In the States, it's in July. And in both countries, there's an effect on mortality. There are blips in mortality.
Well, I was going to ask about that because you mentioned the date in August, and then there's the one in July for the United States. So this is a time of great transition in medical schools and obviously not a great time to be in a hospital.
Yeah. There's a paper I've just been writing about today for something else, Why July Matters, in the Journal of Academic Medicine from a few years ago. I mean, there is a well-noted little blip. It's not a huge blip, but it's a blip. And what I find, and one of the reasons why I included this chapter, was, you know, it can be planned for. We know that it's going to be the first Wednesday in August ad infinitum. Why did somebody, this doctor who told me, but again, I was hearing a similar story this morning in my consulting room. This doctor, you can't plan for somebody being on sick leave, but one guy was on a course, one guy was on annual leave. Why?
Oh, so you can't change the student cycle. There are going to be graduations.
But why can't you factor in the support? We know, as in hospitals in the States, they know it's going to be whichever day it is in July.
Which raises the obvious question, why are things done the same way over and over again? And you bring up examples of countries where things are a bit better, like the New Zealand model.
Yeah. Yeah, the New Zealand is really impressive. They are kind of understand that this is a huge transition from being a medical student where it's pretty much all theory. Yeah, you get practical procedures, but you're never responsible for patients. You can't be legally responsible for patients. To suddenly, you are responsible. That's a huge, it's a bit like, you know, being pregnant and having your first child. And in New Zealand, they have a year. They call it an intern year, but it's not an intern year like you have in the US. We call it foundation in the UK, because you are still a medical student, but you are paid, and I suspect that this is a big, big reason why it's not adopted more widely. You are paid about a third to a half of the salary of a first-year doctor, and you are really doing a lot of stuff, but everything is checked out.
So there's always somebody there at your elbow to back you up?
There's always somebody there, but you are doing stuff. You can be, you are left to really kind of handle stuff, you know, so it would have been like the doctor with the ashen grey patient thinking, I don't know what to do here, but there would always be somebody to call.
Carolyn Elton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about physicians and the things that they go through on their end of the transaction. Sometimes they fear coming into the exam room. Her book is called Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors, and she's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. I did want to ask you about the case of Rose Polge. This is a big one that pointed up to the mainstream media in the UK some of the issues with medical training.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've looked online. She had the most, I didn't know her. I didn't have the privilege of knowing her, but she had the most gorgeous, gorgeous smile.
25 years old, yeah.
Yeah. And because in England, it's perhaps important to say to your listeners, in England, we start medical school straight from high school. That might seem crazy for many US listeners, but the majority, there is a graduate entry program, but that's about 10%, 90% of medical students start at 18.
Wow.
So you can be really, really young when you come out. Med school is 5 or 6 years, it's a bit longer. Mm-hmm. But the pressures of the service, they're different from the US, but you can have rota gaps, you can have supervisors who aren't as, you know, who don't give you the support that you require or are dismissive or any number of different reasons. You can be left feeling you're floundering and you can go and ask for help. And there's a culture of not asking for help, but you can say, you know, you can say to yourself, this is patients' lives, I have to go and ask for help. And you can be just brushed aside. And every year, and the same thing tragically happens in the States, in Canada, in Australia. Every year, there are junior doctors who are committing suicide.
And she just threw herself into the ocean on the
She walked into the sea, mm-hmm. and eventually her body was found. The following year, somebody walked into the sea. a similar point, similar kind of part of the UK, and her body was never found.
You know, and you point out that hers is not the first case, and not the last either. Then there had been a study of young doctors in the UK in the 80s that found some of the deficiencies in the training program, but didn't produce any changes from the sounds of it.
And I found that really distressing when I was researching the book. There was a psychologist who had a kind of similar role to myself, but 20 years ago, she's retired now. And she was a clinical psychologist in a hospital in the UK, and two junior doctors committed suicide, and nothing was said in the team of residents. The attendings didn't talk about it. It was just as if it hadn't happened. And these two interns went to seek out this psychologist because they were so distressed. And she then started a study. And what she wrote about is saying it's unacceptable, the burden of depression and anxiety in this population. And then she repeated it 20 years later. It was the same. And this is not a problem of the NHS. I really want to make that clear. There are similar studies in the U.S.
Okay, not just the National Health Service.
This is not, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And there are papers in the Journal of the American Medical Association, very recent papers talking about an epidemic of burnout.
There's an irony here that you point out, and you don't put too fine a point on it, but that medicine is often about prevention, and yet the same sorts of prevention techniques don't seem to be applied to training.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I talk about in the conclusion that the mantra of medical education, of medical practice, is evidence-based practice, and that's right. We don't, as patients, we don't want to be given medicines or treatments that haven't been, that there isn't a reliable scientific evidence for. But there is, the evidence-based practice is never applied back to doctors themselves. And I give an example in the book. For example, I don't know if it's still the practice, but at Stanford Medical School, when there was research showing that if you base admission on MCAT, the Medical College's admissions test, didn't predict later performance in the licensing exams. So there's no point in waiting all your selection into medical schools on MCAT because it doesn't actually predict how well a student's going to do later on. And yet that research came out of Stanford, but the admissions committee didn't know about it.
Wow. Carolyn Elton is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is a British vocational psychologist, has been working with doctors for decades, and founded the Careers Unit under the National Health Service in the London area. You can join us as we talk about her book that looks at the lives of doctors. They do have their own lives. It's called Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors. You can join the conversation on the Exchange and share stories of your own, either as patient or as doctor or trainer, perhaps, of doctors. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jefnet.org. The book is not all about training. It's also about people who do succeed, get into the profession, and then find some issues along the way, which brings me to a question about the innate ability of people to care for others. Did you observe great variability among the people you've met over the years?
Sure. I mean, of course. I think it's a very kind of controversial question, the extent to which empathy can be trained or not. And I would see that people have a different starting point naturally, but everybody can be improved in their capacity to be empathic to the patient. However, what we know beyond any doubt is that if you're tired, if you're burnt out, if you're overstretched, if you are being bullied or humiliated or belittled, that's your enough is going to have an effect on your capacity to be empathic to your patients.
Did you find many doctors who had the skills? I mean, they were really good technical doctors, but just didn't have bedside manner?
I wasn't. In a previous job, I was watching, I was observing doctors actually in their clinical work as a psychologist, because I was trying to improve the quality of medical teaching. I'm not entirely happy with this, in a way it's a bit like the caricature of House.
Mm-hmm. Which I've avoided talking about, but here we are.
that you can be this brilliant clinician, but have a lousy manner with patients.
I think it's not as simple as that, because actually, if you don't have a good manner with patients, they may not tell you something very intimate or very embarrassing, or something that they're a bit of ashamed about. And that might be a key bit of the diagnostic puzzle. So it's not actually the case that good communication skills can be sort of removed from what it is to be a good doctor. It's an inherent part of being a good doctor.
It's all mixed in there together.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I noticed you mentioned some examples in the book of how young patients in particular bring some fears among doctors. Why?
Well, I mean, if you take the most extreme, if you take preterm babies in a neonatal unit, they are tiny. If you're trying to fit, you know, if you have to intubate or cannulate, or, you know, in some way insert some tube or give them an injection or whatever, they are tiny. So just in terms on a very practical level, but also I think that what I argue, because I'm a psychologist and I'm interested very interested in the emotional aspects of medical work, is that they are perhaps the most crystal clear example of extreme vulnerability, a very, very, very preterm baby. And they therefore quite instinctively can induce a lot of alarm, particularly if somebody themselves has experienced periods of acute vulnerability.
Yeah, there's a section in the book where you mention a doctor or two who just talk about, oh, I don't really want to go back to the neonatal unit.
Yeah, it's quite, I have see a lot of doctors, and I don't know if it's quite the same, I imagine it is. In England, in the UK, you can't be a general paediatrician, can't even be a community paediatrician if you haven't had some experience in the neonatal ward. You can specialize in neonatology, but you have to get through quite a bit of neonatal work just to be a general paediatrician.
All right, so you can't say I'm going to work on toddlers and never be in the neonatal unit.
You can't do that.
All right. So I wonder what that does, though, particularly with the doctors who are handling children who might be verbal, but, you know, they're still very young, don't really understand what's going on. And I just wonder what that does to a young doctor, making little kids occasionally scream in pain.
Well, it's extremely distressing for them. And what we know, there's an American author, Danielle Offrey, who's written a book, What Doctors Feel, who was, I think, initially a pediatrician, but then she changed. And she's written quite a lot about how distressing it can be to have to do very different, to see children suffer. And again, from the US, there is a very important movement called the Shorts Round Movement that came out of Mass General in Boston, which is providing a space and time for staff to actually sit down and talk about, not only medical staff, but actually all staff, not only clinical staff. But if they've had a particularly distressing case, there are opportunities to sit down in a very no-holds-barred, non-judgmental forum to have a think about it. But these sorts of spaces and times are quite new. And before, you just have to get on with it. And, of course, it had an effect. And the most common effect is that you kind of shut down to some extent.
Sure.
And then your patients suffer because you don't see them as a kind of real suffering patient. You've put a barrier between the patient's suffering and yourself.
So the Schwartz rounds, as you describe in the book, are about actually doing some discussion away from the bedside
Absolutely, away from the bedside in protected time. And the origin is very interesting. There was a lawyer, Ken Schwartz, who was in his 40s or early 50s, was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. And he was a lawyer who worked in healthcare. He knew about the pressures on healthcare in the US. And he was so moved when he had encounters with clinicians who recognized what he was going through, and so appalled by some of the technically proficient but emotionally cold encounters he had, that he wrote an article about it in the Boston Globe. And then his family, in his memory, set up a foundation. And the Schwartz Round movement has spread throughout the world. So that's some good news.
And this is not the rounds as we see on the medical dramas on TV.
Full,
so this
full
is
short transfer. Patient relatives aren't necessary. Patient. It's when a group of people who are involved in hospital workers get together with a facilitator who may be a pastor, who could be a psychologist or psychotherapist or psychiatrist, and they have protected time just to talk about how a certain case or number of cases have left them feeling. And junior clinicians will talk about how impactful it is to see senior clinicians, you know, weeping or talking about the impact that this has had in them, or how it reminds them of something from many years ago in their career, or whatever it is. And you don't want to be doing that in front of the patient, but you need some space for doing that, because otherwise, automatically and unconsciously, the doctor will shut down emotionally.
We'll talk about the otherwise in just a few moments. We'll take a break here on the Jefferson Exchange and come back and talk more with Carolyn Elton about her book, Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors. You can join the conversation by phone or by email. We'll come back to the conversation with Carolyn Elton and Also Human in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the British vocational psychologist Carolyn Elton, who has been working for doctors for many years now and has had a chance to observe what their lives are like behind the stethoscope. Because when we go to see doctors, we often have some issues of our own to deal with. We're feeling vulnerable, but sometimes they are as well. And she points this out and talks about issues in training, issues in carrying out the duties of doctoring in a book called Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors. You can join the conversation on the exchange with either perspective, doctor or patient or trainer for that matter as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Carolyn, given that you've been working with doctors for a couple of decades now, do you work with any other professions anymore?
I see an occasional dentist. So I started off working with people from all professions, but there was such a need for working with doctors. And then I, as you said, I founded this NHS-funded service. And nowadays, I work privately, although I did quite a lot of consultancy with the NHS. There's enough work with doctors to keep me busy. And in both the UK and the US, of course, there's so many different there's slightly different numbers of specialties, but we've got about 64 in specialties in the UK. I think there are a few less in the States, but they're more subspecialties. Whatever, vast numbers of different specialties that you can choose from, and I think doctors are so pleased to have to come and see a psychologist who kind of has a good understanding of the range of different specialties.
Which, as I was asking before, I mean, you had to have some knowledge of medicine, at least to be conversant with them about the issues of their job.
Well, quite serendipitously, my previous role, I had been watching doctors. I was a kind of consultant advisor trying to improve the quality of teaching that attendings gave to their residents or medical students. So I used to scrub up and go into an operating theatre, or I would shadow on a ward round, or I would sit in an outpatient clinic. So I spent 10 years watching doctors. And alongside that, I did career counselling of everybody other than medicine. And then my two jobs joined together. So I think the fact that I had spent 10 years watching doctors at work was very, very useful. And that's why I eventually took the decision, even though I still get requests from people other than medicine to help, I now say, no, I only work with doctors.
We were talking about the Schwartz rounds, a chance for the trainees and the doctors, the professional doctors, the fully confirmed doctors, to get together and talk about things away from the ears of the patient and just sort of discuss cases. And it sounds like decompress a bit. You said if that doesn't happen, then often the doctors will shut down. And you talk about suppression and repression as coping strategies. Is either one better than the other?
Well, I think both. As a psychologist, I would say that there are times when suppression is you're consciously making a sort of determined effort to push something aside, and repression, you're not even aware of it. I think there are, of course, there are times where you have to consciously, as a doctor, you have to consciously decide, you know, if you have to do something to a child that they are going to find unpleasant. You can't be absolutely overwhelmed by a desire not to cause distress to that child. Because, you know, if you have to give it, and actually another great book, How Doctors Think, by an American, Jerome Gripman, he gives a case of a desperately ill patient with leukemia who was fighting off a sort of life-threatening infection. And he was, it was a young man, and they came and examined him, and he really didn't want to be turned over, because he was aching all over his body, so they didn't turn him over. And he actually had an abscess under his buttock, which they caught in time, but it could have killed him. And so, yes, you have doctors have to be able to, and nurses, do things to their patients, which the patients are going to find very, very distressing.
Well, and that raises a question that I've thought about for a long time, which is about how doctors push aside their own squeamishness and what it is that they have to do to be able to cut into another person's body and yet have some kind of human level rapport with this person without feeling, hey, I'm sorry I did this to you, while they're awake.
Well, firstly, I mean, not all doctors are going to be surgeons.
Sure.
So some really have got two left hands. they know, you know, some of those who go into specialties where there's very little procedure work, if they're going to go into psychiatry or public health or whatever, they'll get through what needs to be done in med school. But there is a kind of academic debate about how doctors do that. And Some people argue, I mean, certainly everybody would argue that doctors need the capacity to be able to switch off. But one of the people who's written best about this is Michael Crichton of ER, and the late Michael Crichton in Jurassic Park fame. And he talks about it as for most doctors, there's an off switch when the things they have to do, they are just cutting out the emotional impact of it, but the best doctors learn how to regulate, and I see it more like a dimmer switch.
Mm-hmm.
So that the best doctors, and things like the Schwartz round, but all sorts of other interventions as well, can help doctors be able to do it. So if they've got to do something which the patient is going to find distressing, and they will find distressing doing it to the patient, they can shut down. But that is a temporal event. And it doesn't stop them. Outside of that, they can regulate and then switch back on, not in a phony way, but in a real way. They can then switch on the capacity to interact with a patient.
It's like some of those professions like fighter pilot or even soldier, where you have to switch into a certain mode while you're doing your job.
Yeah.
There are people, you point out in the book, who had to stop working as doctors to be healthy themselves. Is this a fairly common thing that you find?
There's a lot, again, in the UK and the US, a lot of doctors talk about leaving. And if you ask doctors, might you leave in the next 5 years, the figures are very high. But if you then, the one group of researchers in the States then followed up a group who said they might leave, and mostly they hadn't. And that's for a whole host of different reasons. But you've gone, I mean, amongst others, is the sheer practicality of it. You've gone through a long and expensive training, and it's trained you to be a doctor. It hasn't trained you to be a lawyer or a fighter pilot or an advertising executive. So, yeah, there are some that leave, but it's very tricky to leave. It's not a straightforward process, and that's some of the most complex work with clients that I do. Really helping them make sure that they do want to leave, and then if they do, identifying what else they're going to do and helping them make that transition. And often they're family members, and there can be also colleagues, and I refer to them, I don't call it in the book, but I often use this with the doctors I see. They're like a Greek chorus wailing in the wings, just wailing and lamenting, oh, you'll regret it, oh, it's such a waste, oh, you shouldn't do that.
Oh, all those years of training down the drain,
all that
sort of thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure. I want to come into another aspect of difficulties that doctors feel, and this is induced by other doctors, and you bring up, there's a whole section on sexism and racism in the book, in particular, there's stories of women surgeons and the treatment they got while they were pregnant just astounded me.
Yes, I mean, this is, and although some of the work that I was referring to was about 15 years ago, there are also very contemporary studies indicating that this, not across in every single hospital, but the argument that drawing on an anthropologist, Joan Castle, I was making is that surgery embodies masculinity. And what she's saying with that is that the inherent masculinity is expressed through the body of the actual body of the surgeon. And she talks about pilots, racing car drivers, a couple of other professions which she thinks embody masculinity. And therefore, a female body in an operating theatre is culturally seen to be that of a patient rather than of a surgeon. And a pregnant surgeon is a very female body in an operating theatre. It's a very female surgeon. And certainly I have had horror stories from clients. And since the book has been published in the UK, it was published in March in the UK, so many letters from female surgeons saying, I can't believe, you know, some people have written to me saying, it was eerie. I felt that you knew my history.
Huh. Wow. And so I understand that in the UK there have been some moves, certainly to deal with racism in the medical profession, where there seems to be a slower movement on that in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things which I think is deeply shocking, and I work in the UK, so I can say this without fear of somebody slapping my wrist afterwards, but the National Resident Matching Program, which is responsible for placing 30,000 doctors each year from medical school into their first job, working as an intern in the US, they collect no data on race and no data on gender. And they cannot know what is going on, although we can suspect. However, there was a really clever study that was done a couple of years ago, and I think it was based on applicants to a Yale Medical Center, and they looked at the people who had applicants to who were Alpha Omega Alpha, I think it's a medical honor society, which is a very big deal, I think. And they were able, because they had all the data, they could control for all the college grade point average, MCAT scores, everything else that they had done. They had all that data. And they found that when you controlled and kept all of that constant, white students were 6 times more likely to have got into Alpha Omega Alpha than black medical students. And they were 2 times more likely than Asian medical students. So there are some very real issues in both the UK and the US. But at least in the UK, we are measuring it.
I wonder about pressures on doctors in the future, particularly because there won't be as many older colleagues to turn to. This is an issue in the United States, I think, coming up because we got so many baby boom age doctors retire. My doctor retires in 11 days, for example. So,
yeah, my doctor's retiring this year too.
So I mean, what kind of pressure does that put on the doctors who are left behind? They can't, you know, call upon the years of experience of the people who trained them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in those sorts of situations, and traditionally there's been a lot of medical migration across the world as well. But we know that that's not going to be popular in the US. You know, you call in doctors from other parts of the world who may have relevant experience. I think that's it's a very real concern. And when you have the feminization of the medical profession, there's all sorts of great things that come with that. It's not that men can't be empathic, of course they can be, and it's not that women are invariably empathic, of course they're not. But undoubtedly, and there's also interesting studies, some American studies that show patients do better with women, not invariably, but there's some interesting work on that, with women physicians. that also is going to affect how working lives, because they, at this point, only women, not men, can get pregnant.
That is true, and we'll stay that way for a while, I'm sure.
I think it's going to stay that way for at least a little while. So I think, but the kind of longer, certainly in the UK, and I suspect in the US, longer-term workforce planning has never been a great skill that healthcare systems have had.
But as you point out, and we just have about a minute left here, that there are efforts to address burnout. For example, Stanford Medical just hired a chief physician wellness officer.
That's right. He's a guy called, he's an oncologist, he previously at the Mayo Clinic, called Tate Schoenfeld. So I've never met him, but I've read a lot of his work. And I think what marks his work out from, not that burnout or wellness hasn't been addressed, but what marks his work out as really as an exemplar is just quite how extensive it is. He's saying this affects every aspect of life in the hospital.
So take care of the emotional well-being of the doctors as well as things like staff infections. You have to, part of the background.
Absolutely. It's an integral part of a functioning hospital.
We learn a lot in this book about the training of doctors. And yes, it is as bad as it seems on TV, certainly in the United States. The book is called Also Human, The Inner Lives of Doctors, and it goes well beyond training to the way they feel about day-to-day practice. You'll learn a lot. Carolyn Elton is the author, a British vocational psychologist, has worked with doctors for decades and founded the Careers Unit under the National Health Service in the UK. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.